Ventu Cuyape.
Yes.
Okay, I got it now. And you are?
I am in a fellowship program called Urban Arts Leadership. It's being sponsored by Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. And under the direction of Kabibi Ajanku. And we are working on a project called Beauty Beneath the Blight. The project is aiming to catalog some of the history and culture of Baltimore prior to 1968, especially in West Baltimore and along the Pennsylvania Avenue corridor. And I'm friends with Tasha, and so I was talking to her about the project, and she said, yeah, my grandmother grew up right over there on Pennsylvania Avenue. I said, really? So I asked her if she and you might be willing to do an interview. So she gave me the pleasure of interviewing her in particular for the project, though I've known her for a long time, and she loves on my baby all the time. But she did give me your contact to see if you would be willing to interview as well. For the project.
I would be willing to interview. What I want you to do when we finish on this letter, send me everything in a text.
No problem.
Just what you said. You are an organization. I just like to have validation for anything I do because I forget. I'm old. I forget.
No
problem. I gotta write everything down. I can't remember anything. So I just want to have it.
Okay.
And if you will text it to me when we finish, then I'll have it for my record. But you may go ahead at any time you're ready.
Okay. And so what I'll do is I'll send you the text, and then I'm also going to send you an email. Do I have permission to record this interview to go into the archive?
Yes, you do.
All right.
Yes, you do.
Okay. So I'm just going to... basically have a conversation with you, ask you a few questions, and ask you to share what you have with us. And I'm going to do an intro. And I think that there's actually some points that I have a question because I talked to some people who've mentioned Ms. Jackson. So perhaps you guys have had some history with one of the other people who I've interviewed thus far. Miss Mellosong Edwards, her father was an A-rabber named Blue. And I don't know, she said when she went to school, she had a Miss Jackson for a teacher or a principal at that point. So I'm not sure if that might be you.
Did she say what school she went to?
She did. She said she went to 100, and then later on, she transferred to... you know what? I don't have those notes in front of me. But I think she went to Douglas for high school.
Okay.
But I will go back and look at it because I did not bring that particular notebook up here.
Okay.
But let me go ahead and start the greeting so that we can have this on record. Good afternoon. My name is Ventu Cuyate, a cohort 2020 member of the Urban Arts Leadership of Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance under the direction of Kabibi Ajanku. This program is sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts, a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, and partnered with Library of Congress, as well as Smithsonian Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2020, and I am on the third floor of my home on Woodington Road in Edmondson Village of Baltimore, Maryland. I am joined by Miss Peggy at S. Jackson, and we are beginning her interview. Miss Jackson, is there another way that you would like to introduce yourself? Any other names that you're known by that you would like us to know?
No, I was an elementary school teacher, junior high school teacher, a high school teacher. Then I became a principal. Before that I was a coordinator, then principal, and then supervisor facilitator.
Okay.
In Baltimore City and supervisor facilitator for the state of Maryland through Johns Hopkins University for restructuring schools. I'm the mother of three. I went to public schools in Baltimore, attended Coppin State College, attended Towson, and I attended University of Maryland School of Law and Johns Hopkins. I guess that's about all. Is that enough?
Yes, it's fine. I guess being that you have so much life to share, I don't know which might be the best starting point. So with the project, we are looking to know some more about life on Pennsylvania Avenue and West Baltimore, and just how you experienced some of the changes that happened throughout the years. What year were you born, Miss Jackson?
1939.
Mm-hmm. And you were born right here in Baltimore?
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At Providence Hospital, which was the black hospital. Mm-hmm. Not too far from Pennsylvania Avenue on Division Street. That's where all the black folks were. Mm-hmm. Providence Hospital is no longer there.
Mm-hmm. And, are your parents also from Baltimore as well?
Both parents were born and raised right here in Baltimore. Mm-hmm.
About how many generations deep do you go in Baltimore, or has your family been born in Baltimore? About how many generations deep? Is it all of the family that you've known that's been in Baltimore, or do you know if you guys came up from any other states to get to Baltimore?
Oh, no. Their parents mm-hmm. were not born in Baltimore. Both grandmothers were from outside of Baltimore. My mother's mother came from Harford County, mm-hmm. and my father's mother came from Virginia. She is a story behind her coming here, too, because I was told that they lived on a plantation, mm-hmm. and that at one time she had been confronted by the owner's daughter and called out of her name. And my grandmother responded, and her response was not only verbal, but I think it was physical, as the story goes. And they had to ship my grandmother out of Virginia that same night. It was the Saunders Farm or Saunders Plantation, and that was their name. They were Saunders, and they had to spirit her out of there, and they sent her to Baltimore, where there were some relatives, because she was going to be taken to task for her response to the farmer's daughter who had disrespected her. And that's a tale that has gone down in the family. My grandmother was a very high-spirited, very vocal woman who was a teacher, and subsequently became a teacher in Baltimore.
Wow. That's amazing. So when she came here, she became a teacher?
Uh-huh. She went to school and became a teacher and met my grandfather, and they were married. He was a chauffeur for the elite up on Charles Street. And they were Seventh-day Adventists. Mm-hmm. and they later parted because of their religious differences. But she had five children, one of which was my father.
Mm-hmm. What is your grandmother's name?
Rachel A. Roselle. That's my paternal grandmother. And my maternal grandmother was Emma Jackson. I'm sorry, Emma Atkinson.
Okay.
And she was a resident of Sandtown. Sandtown is the community where the Freddie Gray situation started.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a matriarch in the community when they started to have a Sandtown reunion years ago. They honored her at their first reunion because she was like a matriarch. She had nine children, but she worked for the rich white folks who were very good to her. And her husband, my grandfather, worked on the B&O Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very good job at that time because he was a lineman on the track. They fixed the tracks or kept the tracks open so that the trains could run. When the train, when there was some obstruction or something wrong to the tracks, they would have to work long hours. And when he worked long hours, he would have food. Food was sent to those B&O workers on the railroad by one of the cafeteria restaurants in Baltimore City. We don't have them anymore. But there used to be one called Horn and Horn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a cafeteria restaurant. You all know, if you're from the South,
I've been to a Horn and Horn before.
Huh?
Yeah, they had them when I was growing up, but then they soon closed after that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, they had a contract, the railroad had a contract with Horn and Horn, whereby whenever the men who worked on the track had to work overtime, and sometimes they would have to work till wee hours of the morning, then Horn and Horn would bring these big containers of coffee and these huge sandwiches, I'll never forget, and big buns and cakes to the men. And because my grandfather was a leader, I don't know what his title was, of the group, then he often brought home when the shift was over sandwiches and coffee and cakes and buns to the family, and my grandmother would give them to the people in the neighborhood. I can remember hearing her telling different people to go up Bruce Street. That was a small street close to Lawman Street, and call so-and-so's mother and get so-and-so to come down here and get food. She gave them food. She also gave them furniture when the white people that she worked for gave her furniture. They would change their furniture like every two or three years, and they would give whatever furniture they had to Miss Emma. And Miss Emma, which was my grandmother, would get my uncle, her son, who worked for United Clay and had a truck, to go out to to Roller Park, Lutherville, Timoney, or wherever she was working, and get all this furniture. And they would bring it back to the neighborhood. And my grandmother would say, you know, call, it would be a call out. Miss Emma got furniture. And they would come down to the truck, and she would have mattresses that they didn't use, bureaus, ice boxes, anything that my uncle could get on the truck that they didn't use. And she gave it to the people in the neighborhood. And that happened like twice a year, I know. I can remember him coming, and my grandmother would say, Arthur, you got to go out to Miss Bluch's. She got new furniture. And he would say, okay, Emma, when my shift is over or when he stopped working for United Clay, he hauled bricks. He would go out there to the white neighborhoods and come back with this truck. He had a big truck because he hauled bricks. And the people from the neighborhood, they would be so happy. I remember that very vividly because she would stand on her front and call out, Jimmy Jones, go tell your mother and Aunt Louise and Patricia, come down here, offer coming on the truck with the furniture. And I would watch. The people came and brought the furniture. So then she did that. And when my grandfather would bring all this stuff home from the railroad, I remember the first time I saw bananas. I didn't know how bananas grew. You know, you used to go into the store and see a bunch of bananas, but you didn't know that they came in a big bunch. And my grandfather used to bring these big bunches. It was down his back. He would be holding on with one hand to this bunch of bananas that went down his back. And I remember as a child being fascinated because I had no idea. That's how bananas came, and they would put them on the front, and people from all the neighborhoods would come and get bananas on whatever he had from off the railroad. So when they started to have a Sandtown reunion, my grandmother was the first person that they honored for her benevolence to the community. And old people in the neighborhood knew Miss Emma. And since I've been an adult, I've heard people have said, you lived on Woman Street? I said, yeah. Where did you live? And I tell them, oh, you lived in that block by Miss Emma. Yes, we knew Miss Emma. She was a very compassionate, giving person. And on my father's side, that was my mother's side. On my father's side, my grandmother, Rachel A., sent students to Coppin, and she fed students. I remember she had students that she helped pay their way to Coppin to become teachers, and she also was a giver. She used to buy, at that time in the classrooms, they had boxes of graham crackers. They came in a big brown box. You know, you don't know nothing about that. And we had little jills of milk, little glass jills of milk. And the milkman would come and leave them. And my grandmother would always have these boxes of graham crackers, huge boxes, for her children in her classroom that she taught, and milk for them. You had a lunchtime, but this was before lunchtime. She would hand out graham crackers, and you got two graham crackers, which had four parts to them, and you got a little jill of milk. She did that every day. But I can remember her giving them out to the children because the children were hungry. So I come from a line of ancestors, grandparents, who were used to giving, you know, and helping, very active in their communities and in the church as well.
Mm-hmm. And Arthur, what is your grandfather's name?
My grandfather's name was Arthur Atkinson. Mm-hmm. And he worked on the railroad, as I say. He was in the Navy. He worked on the ship when he met my grandmother. And I remember my grandmother telling me that they bought that house on Lorman Street for $300. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of money. $300 they paid for the house. You can't buy a house for $300. Mm-hmm. And they thought that was huge. They didn't think they were going to be able to do it. But she would say when my grandfather was in the Navy, he was on a ship and he would send money to her. And I think she said something like $1 or $2 or something. always went to pay for the house.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that the first house that you recall that your family was in, the one on Lorman Street?
No, that my father's family, yes. Mm-hmm. My mother's family mm-hmm. lived on Lorman Street. That was their house. That was where they were born.
Mm-hmm.
That was my mother's house mm-hmm. on Lorman Street.
Mm-hmm.
My father lived on Pitcher Street. That's right off of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived on Pressman Street first.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right around the corner from Pennsylvania Avenue.
Okay. And your father's side, are they also generations of Baltimoreans as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They were all born here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Even though my grandmother was not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You said your family's very active in the church as well?
They were, yeah. Mm-hmm. Both. And my father met my mother at church. They met at church. They mm-hmm. always say I was conceived at church.
Mm-hmm.
I belong to one of the historic churches. Mm-hmm. In Baltimore, Sharon Baptist Church,
mm-hmm.
Reverend A.C.D. Vaughn mm-hmm. is the pastor. It's on Pressman and Stricker Street. But it started in a stable, and my great uncle was one of the founding fathers of Sharon Baptist Church.
Wow. And your family still attends that same church today?
Many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, of course, you know, have gone to other churches, but many of us still attend.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us who attend are from my mother's side of the family,
uh-huh.
because my father's side of the family doesn't live in close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
They have moved away from the Baltimore metropolitan area, and they live in New Jersey, they live in Silver Spring or whatever.
Mm.
But my mother's side of the family, my mother had 8 siblings. My father had 4 siblings. And their children, with the exception of 2, but they don't belong to
mm-hmm.
our church.
And you mentioned that you were a teacher. What different schools did you teach at? And what schools did you attend growing up?
I attended school 104.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on Cary Street, right across the street from the Cary Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cary Theater was the theater, the black neighborhood where we would go to watch westerns, Roy Rogers, Wild Bill Hitchcock. On Saturday morning, we lined up and we went to the Cary Theater. It's no longer there. They tore it down.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to school 104, Robert Brown Elliott Elementary. That is a school that is now, I think, apartments for seniors. I think it's a senior apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to junior high school, Francis M. Woods, and then I went to Douglas High School, another historic institution, because Thurgood Marshall went there, and you have a lot of prominent Afro-Americans who attended Frederick Douglass High School, which currently is on a decline.
Mm-hmm.
They don't produce the kinds of students that they used to, and that's because they don't have the budget, because it's the school where the Upton and Sandtown people go.
Mm-hmm.
So it really needs a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
I am currently a member of the alumni board at Douglas, and we're trying to do what we can to help the principal and help the students. But they have taken money away from our school and funneled it into other schools because it's a school services children in high poverty area. And that's that Sandtown, Upton area.
Okay. And then when you finished high school, where did you attend?
When I finished high school, I went to Coppin. I went to Coppin because that's where my grandmother went. It was in the neighborhood. That's where my mother went. But I was too in love to stay in school. So I dropped out. I had my daughter. And then I found out that love wasn't all that. And I went back to school. I went back to Coppin and got a degree. And then I went to Coppin, I went to Towson, I went to Hopkins, I went to the University of Maryland School of Law. I didn't finish. I dropped out. I cursed my children, my brother as well, of starting and not finishing schools because my brother went to Harvard. And at that time, it was something big to have a black guy go to Harvard. And he went to Harvard, but he didn't stay. He did a year, like I did a year at the University of Maryland, and then he left, and he didn't go back. And I didn't go back to law school.
Did you have any particular focus, or what drove you to want to go ahead to university in the first place? And then when you came back, what was your inspiration for finishing?
Well, you mean to go to Coppin? Well, my grandmother went. Coppin was the school. Our church, Sharon Baptist Church, was the church where the dean of Coppin went. Miles W. Connor. There's a building at Coppin, the name of Connor. It was called the Connor building. Miles W. Connor was an educator who was an active Christian worker at Sharon Baptist Church. So in that day, during that time, if you wanted to be a teacher in Baltimore City, you didn't want to go out of the city, you went to Coppin. And if you had any kind of contact, you were able to assure that you were going to get it in, you went to Sharon Baptist Church because that's where Miles W. Connor was the superintendent of Sunday school. And if you were a member of Sunday school, you could probably bet your bottom dollar that that was point to help you to get into the carpet. So a lot of people went to our church just during that time. We had, I would say, 80% of educators went to carpet. Morgan was a liberal arts college. So if you weren't going for education, you went to Morgan. But if you wanted to be an educator in Baltimore City Public Schools, you went to Coppin. And if you thought you weren't going to get in Coppin, then you joined Sharon Baptist Church Sunday School and became an active member. And it seemed like that was the key to making sure that you were going to get into Coppin because that's where Miles W. Connor was the dean. So I went to Coppin because it was, first of all, close in proximity, and secondly, it was the school where my grandmother had gone and my mother had gone, and I didn't want to be an educator because I had been around educators. We lived on Drew Hill Avenue first, and Drew Hill Avenue and McCullough Street were the streets where your educators, your doctors, and your lawyers lived. Mm-hmm. And that was just accepted. If you lived on Drew Hill, McCullough, Utah, Madison Avenue, and those blocks is where, you know, your educators and your lawyers live. So everybody I knew at church, majority of people, had some affiliation with COP and the Baltimore City school system. So, you know, I went to Compton when I first got married, but I wasn't disciplined enough. I was busy being in love, and, you know, I didn't have time for school. I wasn't focused. But then when I went back, I was focused. Mm-hmm. And I finished COPPIN in 3 years instead of four. And I worked. I worked at the post office and went to school. I finished in 3 years, yeah.
And Tasha has mentioned that you have worn many hats in your day and have worked so many different jobs and have always been one who's been with the people and with the community.
I guess I'm a survivor, and I always felt that if it could be done and somebody else did it, then I can do it. Mm-hmm. So I had so many jobs. If I start from a teenager, I used to scrub steps, marble steps. We have marble steps in Baltimore. And I would scrub people's steps and get 25 cents a step. On Saturday, I would have my list, and I would have about four people whose steps I scrubbed. And if you don't have marble steps, you don't know. You have like a pumice stone that you had to do the steps with, and I did that. I used to go to the bakery. It was a popular bakery, Chester's Bakery, and they had a day-old place. And I would go get, I had three customers that I would get bread for. There was a bakery called Capital Bakery, which used to sell cake crumbs. You could get cake crumbs for 3 cents a bag. These children don't know nothing about that. You want chocolate cake crumbs or vanilla cake crumbs? And I would go there and get cake crumbs from Capital Bakery, and bread from Schmidt's Bakery. It was Schmidt's. It wasn't Kester's. That was Schmidt's. And I would deliver it, and I got 25 cents for that. I worked in a Chinese laundry when I was 10, without my parents' knowledge, because I wanted to have my own. I used to like to roller skate, and if you roller skated, you had to have accessories. We wore roller skating skirts, bouffant skirts, and I needed to work and make my little money. So after school, I got this job in the Chinese laundry where I put shirts that had been starched and folded, and they used to come in a brown paper package, and I had to work on the machine. You put the shirts on the machine, and the paper would come back around and go click, and then you turn them another way, and then the string would come down and wrap them, and that's how people got their shirts from the laundry. And I did that, and I was able to do that because I told a Chinese man that I was older than I was always big for my age. Mm-hmm. And poor man, he hired me. So after school, 2 days a week, I would run around there and work for an hour, but it made me late coming home. My father worked for the post office, And my mother worked at a factory, a sewing factory, Perfect Garment Company. So they didn't get home from work until about 4:30. But I was supposed to be home with my brother, who was 4 years younger. And I would run out of school, get my brother, take him to the house, and I would run on my job. And then my father found out. And he came one day, he followed me, and he saw where I went, and he almost did bodily harm to me.
Hello? Mrs. Jackson? Mrs. Jackson? I'm going to hang up and call back.
Hello?
Yes, I think we got disconnected.
I think I must have hit the mute button.
Oh, okay.
And I used to go. I was in fifth grade, but I was 10 years old when I was six or my eight. And I didn't come home from school right away. I would just be getting in the house when my parents got home from work. And my brother had been by himself because I would pick him up from school and drop him off, and then I'd run to the Chinese laundry and work. And my father decided one day to see why I was bringing my brother home, the way I was born, et cetera. He almost did bodily harm to that little Chinese man. I feel sorry for him because he was so angry. But the man thought that I was older and I could work. I think I worked there about 3 weeks before they found out what was going on. But I got an allowance. And I would take my allowance and the money that I made delivering bread and washing steps, and I would buy material at Tommy Tucker's. That was a store in Pennsylvania Avenue. Tommy Tucker's and J.J. Brill. They were five and dime stores, and they had the best material. And I had sewing in school, so I knew how to make a broomstick skirt, and I would make my skirts for skating rink. And I had all kinds of material because I would have a lot. Some weeks I would have like $7 counting my money, and my mom would make me put some in my bank. I had a big old piggy bank. And the other money I would spend on my skating skates and my shoestrings and my pom-pom balls for my skate, because that's what I like to do. So that was my early work experience. Then when I got into high school, I had a cousin who had a very lucrative business in a restaurant. If you lived here, you knew about Samson's Restaurant. That's where people went on Fayette Street. And you bought home-cooked meals, Hogmore's, Chitlin's, Pig's Feet, stewed beef and rice, stewed chicken, fried chicken. I learned very bad eating habits by working at Samson's. Big, fat, juicy rolls, syrupy sweet potatoes, all the stuff you shouldn't eat that I didn't eat because my mother didn't cook it. I didn't know about Hogmore's and Chitlin's until I went to Samson's, and then I learned to love it. Hogmore's, Chitlin's, Pig's Feet, because I worked there. It was a very popular restaurant. And I made a good amount of money there. I made more working 3 days than my mother made a whole week working at Perfect Garment Company. and our salary was only $4.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember getting $4. $4 a night. That's all. That's what we worked for. And I worked like 9 or 10 hours. That's $4. Mm-hmm. But my money came in tips. We used to take cigar boxes and wrap them up and put sayings on the front of the box we would write on, you know, and cut a hole in it. Mm-hmm. And we would put our tips in there. For Christmas, we'd have those boxes up. We'd try to outdo one another. The waitresses decorate the boxes to see how much tips you could get.
Mm-hmm.
Little Willie Adams. Have you heard of Little Willie?
Yeah, I've heard his name. Is he the numbers runner?
Okay, Little Willie. Yeah, Little Willie Adams. Look him up.
Mm-hmm.
He was someone who came from North Carolina that had a lot to do with the growth of black business in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his friends used to golf. And when they came in from golfing on Saturday, they would come to Samson's restaurant to eat. And the waitresses there, myself and my girlfriend and her cousins, were four of us, we would vie for the opportunity to get their table.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew they were going to give a $5 tip,
mm-hmm.
each of them. And if it was four in this group, that means you had $20.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just for one night,
mm-hmm.
of tips. So at the end of my week of working, I worked Friday, Saturday. I think I worked Thursday. I only worked 3 days. I know it was Friday and Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can't remember whether it was Sunday or Thursday at some point. But I would have over $100. For my time. And back in that day, my mother didn't even have $100 for working at Perfect Garments. So mm-hmm. I was able to do a lot. I saved a lot, and I was able to buy a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of money for somebody who wasn't 20 years old,
mm-hmm.
who wasn't 19. I think I was just, from the time I was 15 to 18, I worked at mm-hmm. Sam's. And then Samson closed, and I started working in the local bars,
mm-hmm.
bars that had restaurants and food service, like Garrison Lounge. That was my first big one. That was the only place that we had at that time to go and eat.
Mm-hmm.
People used to get dressed to go through the Garrison Lounge.
Mm-hmm.
They had a maitre d', and they had one side was the restaurant, and one side was the bar, and then the back was like a big area where you could have parties or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there. I started working in the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
but I found that I couldn't make as much money in the restaurant as I could in the bar. So I transferred to the bar and started working at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I made a lot of money in the bar. But at that time when I worked there, I was still working. I had a regular daytime job. My
mm-hmm.
regular daytime job was, first of all, was Weston House. And I worked at Weston House, and then I worked at the bars on the weekend. After Weston House, I went to work at the post office,
mm-hmm.
but I still worked at the bars, and I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
I have always worked I never just had one job, because one job wasn't enough. And at that time, by the time I started working at the post office, my husband and I had separated.
Mm-hmm.
And I was determined that my kids were going to have everything that everybody else had, even if my husband and I were separated.
Mm-hmm.
My kids went to camp for 2 weeks every year. They went to camp. The girls went to charm school. They went to dance class. My son went to baseball clinic. So I wanted to work, and I might say that I guess my priorities were skewed because I think my kids might have fared better if I had just stayed home. But I wanted a nice home, mm-hmm. you know, and I wasn't satisfied with just having a little bit. We moved on Longwood Street. Mm-hmm. That at the time was a very nice neighborhood. It was only houses on one side. We had a park right in front of us. And in the block where I lived, it was nothing but school teachers, lawyers, postal workers. So mm-hmm. you lived on Longwood Street back in the day, and you overlooked the park. That was a part of Ashburn. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be, you know, you're doing good. And it was like, I was the only one in the old block who had young children. I was the only one who was working two or three jobs to maintain all the people who were related to the owners of the Afro newspaper lived there. Judge Foreman lived there. What's his name? The Woods family lived there. The girl who was a singer, I can't think of her name now. Oh, her husband was Biddy Woods. He was a promoter for singers and band players and whatever. There so were a lot of people there who were much better off than I was, because I was struggling to maintain so that my children could have what I thought they needed. A lot of exposure and a lot of experiences. And now, since I've gotten older, I look back and I just wonder how their lives would have been better if they had more of me, if I wasn't always working all the time. Mm-hmm. And then when I started to teach, I taught, and then, as I said, I became my department chair. And I just went up the ranks. I went up the ranks quickly, they say, but I retired, and I went back to work for Hopkins for a program where I was given a title of Restructuring Implementation Specialist, and I would go around to the schools to help failing schools. Mm-hmm. To help principals and their teachers to succeed, to bring up student scores. I guess that's my history, work history. Did I work anywhere after that? No, that was my last job as a paying job as a restructuring implementation specialist. And I traveled throughout Maryland to the various schools where people were trying to get administrative degrees, master's degrees, and it was a part of the assessment of what they were doing that I functioned. I would critique and, you know, give information back on what I thought they needed. Now I'm trying to think if I had another job after that. No. No, that was my last job, and I think that was in 2007. And then I came home, and I began a full-time job of taking care of my mother who had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And I started going to school to learn about Alzheimer's. I became very active in the Alzheimer's Association. Mm-hmm. to the extent that I belong to. I'm a certified Alzheimer's volunteer. I'm a member of the Hopkins group, which is called MACAB, and that's Minority Advisory Community Association. Mm-hmm. And I belong to ASALA, which is the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History. And I started an administrator's book club. I don't belong to any of the Greek letter organizations, even though I've been told that I should be, but that's not my thing. And in retirement, I'm not bored. Like right now, I have so much that I need to do that I could not, I don't have to do it, but I like to do it. Mm-hmm. Tasha said you want to know something about the stores on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, she sent me a picture of the Royal and I think Chester's. We were also interested in finding out, and you started talking about some of the fashion of the time with the skating wear, anything.
But Pennsylvania Avenue was not as it is today. Mm-hmm. You didn't see, like, at Pindorf, all those people crowded up there. They had a drug store. Well, drugs were not prevalent during that time. They smoked a little pot. Mm-hmm. But you didn't see them gathered up on the corner, those addicts that up there. And we went to the theaters. We had the Met Theater. We had the Cary Theater. We had, Cary wasn't on Cary Street, but we had the Diane Theater. We had the Regent Theater. All these were on Pennsylvania Avenue. And you had the Royal. And the Royal was high class avenue. Plus, we had the White Rice then, and I lived on Pennsylvania Avenue. When my mother and father separated, we moved from Drew Hill Avenue, where we lived, and we moved to Pennsylvania Avenue. No, but that was as a child, and we moved from Pennsylvania Avenue when my mother and father separated and moved to Fanfare. But while I was on Pennsylvania Avenue, we lived in an apartment, and I thought Pennsylvania Avenue was the most beautiful place. It was always lit up. There wasn't any fear of going to Pennsylvania Avenue. You had black stores, the Alpha Shoe Store, which was the black shoe store owned by the Coxes. You had the Alpha Restaurant. You had Sess's Restaurant, which was a black restaurant around the corner from Pennsylvania Avenue. You had the White Rice Inn. And like I said, you had all the theaters, the Diane, the Lincoln, the Regent, the Met up at the top, and of course the Royal. So on the weekends, affluent black folks would get dressed up because they were going to the theaters, going to the movies, going to out to eat at one of the restaurants. The White Rice Inn was very popular, was very crowded. The Alpha Cafeteria was another one. Sess's Restaurant, which was around the corner from Pennsylvania Avenue. So I would be in the house, and I would look out the windows and see the people, the cars, the Honey Dripper. It was a car called the Honey Dripper. And I don't know whether that was an Oldsmobile or what, but it was convertible. And your so-called other affluent people had these cars and the Cadillacs. And you would see entertainers coming into the city who would be going down to the Royal in these cars. And people would get dressed to go to the theater. Women would, you know, put on their finery. And I would look out the window as a young girl. I was young. and watch all the happenings. Men would be dressed up with hats and Stacey Adams shoes and suits. It wasn't a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people felt threatened
mm-hmm.
by being on Pennsylvania Avenue. It was a good place to be when I was a child. The market was there. You had the Charm Center, which was a dress shop where they used to model in the windows. People would be standing on the curb watching the models who were in the store and who would model, like the stage was where the window was, and people would be crowded. They would have these fashion shows for different holidays and different seasons. And by me living in an apartment across the street, I could look down out of the window and see all the fine fashion. And the Charm Center was one of the most affluent ladies' boutiques at that time for the community.
Mm-hmm.
The Charm Center, and then it was a lady who had another store called Pauline Brooks, but that was up off of North Avenue, off of Pennsylvania Avenue. That was on North Avenue. But you saw the teachers and doctors' wives and ministers' wives going into the Charm Center and getting high fashions from New York. That was the place to go. If you had something out of the Charm Center, that was fine. Then there were stores further down Pennsylvania Avenue. There was something called Hendon's. And Hendon's was a white establishment, but they had your high fashion. Some place called Linda Lynn's. These were all stores on Pennsylvania Avenue where black folks shopped.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't catch the streetcar and go downtown to Julius Guttmann's or Braga Guttmann's and those stores, but they shopped on Pennsylvania Avenue. Then you had a men's store on Pennsylvania Avenue. So it was not the kind of fearful place or fearful experience that it is today.
Mm-hmm.
People enjoyed, you went to the market. Well, Lafayette Market, you had all these stalls, legitimate stalls. You had a special stall for lamb, a special stall for beef. Vegetables. You had several stalls. I had no fear. When I look at Pennsylvania Avenue as today, it has changed so. You didn't have people laying on the corners or whatever. Everybody was busy going to work. And it wasn't a bad place, but it is turned around. And I would say it really turned around in the 60s, maybe late 50s it started turning around. Late 50s, early 60s, I would say. But during the 40s and the early 50s, no.
What would you think was one of the reasons? What would you think was one of the reasons that it started turning around?
I think desegregation
mm-hmm.
had a lot to do with it, and I think just the general national climate. Desegregation, school board, what is it, Board of Education, versus Peach, Kansas, that was 54, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think during that time it had a lot to do with it, because blacks, that was a black mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And then when desegregation started, we had other places to go.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't rely on that place
mm-hmm.
For business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went other places. So I think that had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. And the thinking of the black community, you know. Then the opening of Mondawmin mm-hmm. had a lot to do with it. Mondawmin used to be plantation, the Browns owned that. Well, farm, plantation, whatever you want to call it, but it was their land. Mm-hmm. And they sold it and commercialized it. And it was indoor shopping center. And we had never had anything like that. Mm-hmm. So the businesses, some black businesses opened up there, but mostly they were white businesses. And that had a lot to do with it, too, the decline of Pennsylvania.
Well, I have one more question for today. And if it's okay, would it be okay if I called you back another day if I had some follow-up questions?
Sure.
Okay.
I don't mind, because I have started some time ago writing stuff down that I said I was going to try to put into some kind of form, because I look at all these books that people are publishing and other fans. Mm-hmm. They're not saying anything. I can say a whole lot more than I'm reading.
It would be my pleasure to have you again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So just let me know, because, you know, I don't work mm-hmm. and I live alone. Mm-hmm. And I am busy. Tasha says that. I don't know how you do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy it, mm-hmm. you know. And I tell them, I think I need to pass it on to you mm-hmm. all. Because my grandparents passed it on to me. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandmother talked to me. She would say, a penny earned mm-hmm. is a penny saved. Mm-hmm. If you make 3 cents, you save 2 cents and you spend 1 cent. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that. And I have her on tape somewhere, but I can't find it. Mm-hmm. And she had this little black leather purse mm-hmm. with a gold bar, like a little snap on it. And she said, whatever you earn, you save. And both of my grandparents worked. They were hard working. They went to work before the sun rose. And they came home after sunset. Mm-hmm. So I come from two families of workers mm-hmm. and people who are optimistic. If you want it, you can have it. It's out there. Go get it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I told my children. Failure is not an option. You can't be successful unless you fail. Mm-hmm. If you fall down, you get up. And you try it again. And I don't know whether I did so good at that. I think I might have done a little better if I had been home more. Mm-hmm. But those were the choices I made. I wanted them because I was separated. And I didn't have the kind of home that I had grown up in early on in my life with both parents. I didn't want them to suffer. I wanted them to have everything that everybody else had and the experiences. Mm-hmm. And I hear them now, they will say, they're not talking to me, but they'll be talking to other people, and I hear them say, and then my other daughter, she said, Ma, you know, when I hear from other people, I know we had a good life. We had a good coming up. And I said I tried because I didn't want them to suffer just because my husband and I couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. But if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have worked all those jobs. I would have stayed home with them more mm-hmm. than going out to work. I would have worked one job because I rushed my life away. I was always rushing to go from one job to the next. Even as a principal, I worked in the clubs at night mm-hmm. because I found that I made more money working in clubs than I did on a job with a master's degree as a administrator. Mm-hmm. Because I got tips. Mm-hmm. And that was my extra stuff. That was for the vacation y'all wanted. That was for the dance lessons that y'all wanted. The second job was always for the extras. Mm-hmm. The first job paid the bills, but the second job was for the extra. Mm-hmm. And we didn't need the extra. We really didn't, now that I look back on it, but that's the way I thought. That was the materialistic part. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to have things and stuff and go places and have experiences. And I did sacrifice. I sacrificed the time. And if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't. I would have given them more time and not given them the second job. But you live and you learn. And I hope that my children, my grandchildren have learned, you know, that you don't have to have all those things. Mm-hmm. And go all of those places. You know, you have family. Mm-hmm. But anyway, mm-hmm. If you're finished, have we done an hour?
Yes. I think my last quick question was, Tasha had mentioned that you taught one of the founders of Sankofa Dance Theater.
Yeah, I was at Carver High School. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of his name, but mm-hmm. he went to Carver High School. Okay. And I remember this was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. This was in the 70s. And I can see him, and I remember him telling me about it. Mm-hmm. This was afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of his name. And he had a wife. Mm-hmm. But Tasha said that she believes, I could go back to my yearbooks and look, go back to there and flip them, because as time goes by, I can't remember zip. Mm-hmm. But I believe that he was married to somebody, and the lady that he was married to was instrumental in starting Sankofa. But I believe they are divorced and she married somebody else and mm-hmm. she's carrying it on. Mm-hmm. I don't know that as a fact.
So the woman that you speak of is Kabibi Ajanku, and she's actually the woman who is the director of this program.
Well, did she have another husband?
I believe, I don't know Baba's name. I'll ask Mama Kabibi to give me the details. Because
after
when I grew up, I knew of Baba Kuna.
Who attended, mm-hmm. Yeah, who attended Carver High School. Mm-hmm. Because he was so excited. Mm-hmm. And he had a wife and children. He came to the school. A lot of my students would visit me. Mm-hmm. And then I went when he started. I'm trying to think. I think it was up on Jude Park Circle. They had a place or something. Mm-hmm. But then later on, somebody told me that he was divorced mm-hmm. from his wife. Mm-hmm. So I don't know mm-hmm. whether he continued with a new wife or whether the wife got a new husband mm-hmm. or something. But they had several children. Mm-hmm. And he was my student at Carver. They used to call me Action Jack at Carver High School, yeah. And he was a good student. Yeah, but I don't remember his name. But I guess if I go back to one of the yearbooks, but I can see him. I know how he looked, mm-hmm. but I cannot remember his name. So ask her, mm-hmm. did she have a husband that they started Sankofa with together mm-hmm. back in the 70s? Mm-hmm. Or what?
Okay. I just appreciate that Baltimore, you know, and the world gets small as you talk, have a conversation with people. So thank you so much for today, Miss Jackson. I'm going to go ahead and close out for the day. This has been Tukuyate of Cohort 2020 with the Urban Arts Leadership Program under Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance and directed by the Equity and Inclusion Director, Mama Kabibi Ajanku. This is, again, Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. This is a program that is being funded by a grant of National Endowment from the National Endowment for the Arts and partnering with the Library of Congress and Smithsonian Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage. And thank you again, Ms. Jackson. I look forward to speaking with you again, and I really value all that you've shared with us today.
You are welcome. Mm-hmm. And you're going to text me that information so I'll have it that file. Who you are, what you represent.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And whenever you're ready, just call me.
Okay. And then let me just ask, so I know in general, do you also have an email address that I may be able to forward you?
My email address is Peggy S. Jackson at Verizon.net.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too. I'll speak to you soon. Thank you. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.